Imperfect leaders. Are you facing challenges filling open speech language pathologist positions within your district? It's kind of a silly question because I know you are. Empath Speech understands the critical need for qualified professionals in your schools. They recognize that communication lies at the heart of academic success, and that's why they're dedicated to helping you bridge the gap by offering expert therapists and innovative telehealth solutions. Don't let open positions hinder your students' success. Partner with Empath Speech today and ensure every child in your district has access to the speech therapy they deserve. Empath Speech, empathspeech.com. Empowering students, empowering schools. About a year ago, at the one-year anniversary of Justice Ginsburg's death, I was asked by my family to be a part of a school naming committee in Philadelphia. There was a school there considering her name for the new name, and I was to represent the family. And in the end, the school community didn't choose to name the school Ruth Bader Ginsburg Elementary School. Instead, they chose Gloria Casardes Elementary School. And that was the perfect name. Gloria was an LGBTQ+ advocate who served Philadelphia City Hall as the Director of LGBT Affairs from 2008 to 2014. And she actually also attended this school as a child. So again, it was just the perfect way to honor a local hero who died too early. The renaming process did something really rewarding for me too. It gave me the opportunity to meet this week's podcast guest, Julio Nunez. And in the first part of the conversation, Julio tells us about the process for changing the name of this elementary school in the Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia. And in the second part, Julio talks about his first principalship and the intensity of being a school and district leader and the mental health toll it takes on a leader, especially leaders typically underrepresented in leadership roles. Throughout our conversation, I just kept thinking of a quote my aunt famously said, "Fight for the things that you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you." And Julio does just that. It's a great episode. I'm Peter Stiepelman, and this is An Imperfect Leader. Today on An Imperfect Leader, Julio Nunez is my guest. And Julio serves the children, families, the staff as principal of Roosevelt Campus of the Norristown Area High School, just outside of Philadelphia. His leadership journey, which spans a broad range of experiences, is firmly rooted in his desire for service and self-improvement. He values compassion, courage, citizenship, and resilience above all else. Now, Julio studied public policy at Georgetown University, graduated from Temple University with a degree in journalism, economics, and political science, and earned a master's degree in second language acquisition from Drexel University. He is now pursuing his doctoral degree in educational leadership at St. Joseph's University, focused on immigrant and bilingual communities. Julio, welcome to An Imperfect Leader.
Peter, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
I am so thrilled to have you here. There's so much more I wanted to say in your intro, that you've taught and led in schools in Philadelphia for 15 years before coming back to Norristown, the school district, I believe, that you attended as a student. Did I get that right?
That is correct. Coming full circle, when I came here as an undocumented student back many moons ago, over two decades, I went to Norristown Area High School and graduated from there.
I know that you were founding principal and CEO of Independence Charter School West, and that was during your service as a vice principal in the Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia that we actually were connected. You were leading the renaming process of the now named Gloria Casares School. And I was so proud to be a part of that process and so impressed with your leadership, especially how thoughtful you and your team were when it came to actually choosing the name. And I also read the letter that you sent to the school district that served as the impetus for that change. I will tell you, having served as the superintendent when we renamed Robert E. Lee Elementary School, I saw firsthand how renaming a school can bring on some really high emotion. So I wonder, can we start there? Would you talk a little bit about the process of renaming your school and any advice or what advice you'd have for anyone considering such a process?
It was an exciting experience, to say the least. And yes, a lot of emotions, high emotions during it. And the question that we had, this is back in 2019, fall of 2019, I had just started at my school, and the school itself had gone under an independent review by Temple University about how to best educate students, promote higher achievement, and so on. And one of those things that came out was really, does the identity of the community as it stands represent the students that it serves? And it was at best a question mark. So in conversations with my principal, and she was so gracious and just giving me essentially a blank check to, you know, just whatever helps the community, do that. And had that conversation early on, and we learned that the district, even as large as Philadelphia's, didn't have an actual formalized process for renaming schools. It had a process for naming new schools, but not for renaming them. So initially, it took about a couple of years of sort of lobbying and really talking to stakeholders and to district officials as to why that needed to happen. And eventually, they agreed that this was necessary part of our, you know, pursuing our mission as a school. And what gave impetus to that, and you saw in the letter, is the, you know, what happened with George Floyd and the killing and the social unrest that happened in the aftermath. So, you know, we learned from early on that there was quite a bit of support from families, from staff, from students about, you know, something else. What the name of the school was no longer, it was anachronistic. So we went with that and started that process. And it was organic in nature. One of the things that I'd like to point out is that neither my principal nor I had a name in mind at all. We just knew that what we had wasn't working. It wasn't reflective of the values of the school community. It wasn't reflective of who was attending our school. And at the very least, a discussion about what's the best fit.
So it sounds like, if I were to ask you for what advice you'd have, it sounds like first, make sure that there's an actual protocol for changing a name. And so you went about doing that. And I remember reading Philadelphia's process, which I thought was pretty interesting because they had two, one for a regular process and one for an accelerated, and that there were specific reasons for why you might accelerate the renaming of a school. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I didn't know its history in terms of how much of a role your school and your community played in crafting such a policy and such a protocol and a process. So that's really interesting. So first, have a process that is really clear. And then it sounds like you began convening, either surveying or through conversations with your community, taking this information you got from Temple University about probably curriculum and instruction, and then just the school culture. And very much so, a school's name carries with it some type of the cultural field you're going to create. And if it's named after an individual who was so destructive in terms of his belief about Indigenous and First Nations people, we won't say the name of the individual because there's no need to give that person, you know, any kind of airtime. But it's kind of interesting to see when children walk through and cross the threshold into the building, they may be prompted to say, well, who was this person? Or why are we named that? And how that can really contribute to how children feel about the place where they're learning.
Yeah, I think the first part that we did, and it wasn't, again, we were sort of assembling the airplane in mid-flight. For us, it was surveying where our community was as a whole with the school, the current school name. We learned that the major I'm talking about 90%, over 90% of staff, students, families who responded to the survey supported at least a discussion about a name change. But from there, there wasn't a clear sort of community engagement, you know, what steps you take once that approval had happened at the superintendent's office that you can change the name now engage the community as to what it's going to be named.
Two things that I would say. One is, I really felt like you and your team, it was very much like a duck. You didn't really see how much was stressing you out, but no doubt you were moving those feet quite vigorously underwater. The other piece is, I wanted to know how legitimate the support was. And so I knew Bill Hite from my work with AASA. And so I reached out to him. We had a nice conversation and he was so on board about wanting to support the school and its change because I wanted to know whether or not it was tacit, like, yeah, go ahead and go try that. Or no, we have a real opportunity here to give children and the community a chance to rename a school and serve as you said, I think in your letter, sort of like this real push for hope or an ignition to sort of reclaim or restart this ability to really give the community a reset.
Absolutely. I think the, you know, the way we saw it and the argument that we made was, we have this talk about equity. What does that mean for us at the school level right now? And the pursuit of that ran through the name change. It wasn't just an aside or, you know, it would be great if we consider this. It was like one of those central things for everything else that in our view could galvanize the community behind something that, you know, they can create and use that as a catalyst for, you know, for other good things happening in this area.
How do you respond to the criticism that you're erasing history when you rename a school's name? I can't imagine anybody said that to you, but I got that. But I'm sure nobody said that to you.
high spirited conversations we had around that. And that was one of the questions. I think it was a legitimate question to have. And, are we deleting history or are we simply trying to add the perspective of various historically disenfranchised communities, right? And does the school name represent, in essence, the community it serves? And the clear answer was that it wasn't.
In my book and in the leadership model that I use to advise others, there's a dimension, the leader's learning work. And that is really the mind of an organization's work. And inside that dimension, there is a term, applying systems and design thinking. And you described a scenario in a piece that you wrote in 2022, and I'll put this in the show notes as well. But it really speaks to the ripple effect or the unintended consequences of any decision. And in the scenario that you describe, the process of leveling, and now known as enrollment-driven resource review, which could not be any more bureaucratic. Woo! The way I understand it, though, is that each year in October, that schools in Philadelphia are told whether or not they're going to be forced to level, which is like the practice of consolidating classes or essentially eliminating a teacher. And so I want to talk about the consequences of this practice and then how you draw a line from consolidating or eliminating a teacher to gun violence. And you really are speaking to systems thinking, I think. I mean, you urge your readers to connect the dots, connect the dots, connect the dots. And so my question is, having been a teacher in a large metropolitan district, I experienced something similar, especially the lack of a nurse, like don't get hurt on Tuesdays or Thursdays. And then as a superintendent, you know, I made end of the year decisions to either eliminate or increase teaching sections. And I really wish I had read your piece back then. Would you speak to what you described as the rippling and crippling results of such a practice as it relates to meeting the needs of kids? And then I guess, how do you connect it to gun violence?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So working in Philadelphia is a diverse city for those people who are not familiar with it. It's an urban setting. It's one, some cases measured as one of the poorest largest cities in America. So the work of an educator working there is even more complex because of all those challenges. With working with unknowables, I mean, you know, that's quite a bit of the work of a school leader, of a superintendent, working with a lot of missing information sometimes. In the case of our, the practice that, as I understand it to this day, is there of leveling teachers means that you start with a number of teachers based on how many students you have. And if you happen to not meet that threshold, say, for example, you have 29 students versus 28, and the 29th would have given you another teacher, then you have those 28 students that you have to sort of place in other sections, you know. So we had this, and typically schools start with a set number of teachers, right? And around late September, after the 10-day count and all this, and, the schools may reach out to families and know exactly what number of students they're starting with. Those adjustments to the staffing happen, and the movement of teachers within the district happens in early October. So for us, knowing that our enrollment sort of was in decline, the school historically had lost, you know, had lost teachers into the school year. And this was the case this time around as well. We had just grown the school to include fifth grade after asking families, hey, trust us, we'll do the best thing for your child. And they did. 95% of the families who we asked, would you enroll your child with us at this school if we offered fifth grade, They said, yes, we commit to that. And they did. And they sent their children with us. So at some level, it was a little bit of a, we felt like we were breaching a trust with the families, to now going from three sections of fifth grade to two now that are, you know, ginormous. And then the other rippling effects within the building, which is the morale takes a hit. You know, you have one less teacher in the building, and then you have to sort of rework your whole schedule, rotations with the counselors that support those students, etc. So it's quite disruptive. And I hope that, you know, there were talks before I left the district that they were sort of inkling into doing away with it. But there was no reason to have it. And all educators sort of agreed on that.
I imagine there was, thinking of the unintended consequences, everything from the schedules that you just indicated, sort of, you know, art and music and counselor and those types of things, if they exist, because in some metropolitan districts, that becomes the responsibility of the classroom teacher. I imagine also with special education schedules and things like that, that became difficult. Could imagine that in some situations you now had split grades, right? A 2-3 combination or a 3-4 combination, depending on the numbers and things like that. So are all these unintended consequences that can result from that very deliberate act of leveling. And so how do you take that situation, which is really difficult, and how do you then tie it to school violence or community violence or gun violence, as you did in your article?
Yeah, so one of the things that happened when we were going through that is that a young man at a high school in the district of Philadelphia was gunned down while he was in practice after school at his high school. And the perpetrators, as you know, as was later found, were other young people as well. And the question that I raise is, you know, I wonder what their experience of those, the perpetrators, right, quote unquote, or was in school, and at what point did the system fail them? So that was an important question for us to have, that before they are, you know, they are shooters, and as I write, they are students. And, you know, we do hold that level of responsibility to do what is right for every student, and knowing that the experience that they have in school either turns them on to learning or turns them off.
So the connecting the dots, connecting the dots, connecting the dots, and I intentionally say that because that's how you wrote it, is that you are saying schools have a responsibility to build relationships with children. And those who have relationships with their schools are less likely to get involved in violence at school and potentially have other pathways that they've been able to follow, because violence outside of school isn't really necessarily a path worth pursuing because they have all these other opportunities. So if you were to be able to maintain those classes, which have good size numbers, building meaningful relationships with your teacher is good in year one. But the compounding sort of interest in terms of building deeper relationship to your school and opportunities only strengthens your bond to your community, because the schools are a beacon in those communities, right? There are a space there. And so that may lead to better choices, more productive or healthy choices, and away from violence. Is that the dots that we're connecting?
Absolutely. So the theory of action, as we say, right, is that if children have such a positive embracing experience at school, they're not even thinking about anything else other than learning and positive outcomes within their lives.
So I'd like to ask you a question that we ask every guest on the podcast. And the question is, how does the term an imperfect leader resonate with you?
You know, when I think of an imperfect leader, I think about being human, and not a question of making mistakes, but when you're going to make the mistakes. And it is about showing that heart to the community. So when you do make them, they know where you're coming from, and you have that wiggle room, if you will, to make it right. So, you know, as leaders, we make tons of decisions, right, during any day. And we're bound to make mistakes. And the question is, you know, will we hold on to the trust in the community when we do? And I think we do that if we're upfront about why we're doing what we're doing and show our heart. I am a big believer in leading, with vulnerability and just showing, you know, as you are authentically and going from there and using that as the basis for your decision making. I think that's important. And sometimes we'll move away from that and then we end up making more mistakes because we're not authentic, right?
And we'll be right back. Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being. And I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of An Imperfect Leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder, and after some funny looks, they shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class, and the kid next to him like sort of shoved him and goes, "Texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class." I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions. Maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. We're back for segment two of An Imperfect Leader called Imperfect Leadership in After Action. My guest is Julio Nunez, the principal of Roosevelt Campus of the Norristown Area High School, just outside of Philadelphia. And in this segment, we ask our guests to deconstruct a decision that they've made, and then we discuss it. So Julio, what happened?
Peter, I'm deconstructing my decision to accept the job as a principal CEO of Independence Charter School West. And I had the time of my life. It was an intense experience, and you can underline intense. It's something that I believe I was technically ready for. I was competent enough, I think, to do the job. I did it for 3 years. And dare I say successfully, it was a growing school, still is, it was a K-8 school. And the part that I was not prepared for was the mental aspect of the work. And that's something that led me to many, many lessons after that experience.
So you become the founder and principal. That sounds like two roles. And that sounds intense already, even if things were not intense within the building. And as a founder, then you have so many responsibilities, everything from enrollment to curriculum to nutrition services to special education to transportation, all those kinds of things. And so I'm thinking there are so many things that one might say I've overlooked. As we sort of narrow this into the word intense, maybe, what was overlooked in terms of this experience for you?
Yeah, no, I think you do a very very good job of sort of capturing how complex the job is. And, it was a growing school, it was an organization going from K through third grade, and eventually it would become a K through eighth grade in the middle of a large construction project that I was overseeing along with my board. I think going from having one boss to having nine, right? At least nine, and my board was something that took some getting used to, you know, and then just providing those, you know, those updates, those information sessions, if you will, engagement with the community at every board meeting and informing them of the progress of the school. That was new to me. What I didn't consider in doing all of that, and I speak as a Latino leader, as a first college graduate, you always want to do the best job that you can. And I believe is also the case for any leader of color, women especially of color, right? That you have very little wiggle room to make mistakes because your competence will be questioned very quickly. So you work with that level of anxiety and you just learn to cope with it. So you try to become the overachiever at everything that you do. You want to read more than the person, you know, than the other leader is. You want to make sure that you're showing up to everything and everything that's happening in your community, the school community, and all of that. And one thing that you forget to do is to take care of yourself as a human being. And that's something that, in my experience through those 3 years, was intense, and I overlooked completely. I thought that for me, it would be enough to get this number of accomplishments with the school community, and that that would suffice taking care of me, you know, personally, just like being there for my family. And obviously it didn't, right? It took away from that. And I didn't recognize that having boundaries was the healthy way to do it. So for me, saying no was such a difficult thing. And at the other end, you have, well, you still have to sleep. You have to be present for your family. You have to be able to, you know, show up fully as well. And learning to prioritize both is quite a bit of a skill.
You know, I think about the conversations I've had with our colleagues of color, and there's often the phrase, I had to work twice as hard to get as half as far. And I can imagine that when you are in this role of any leadership role, there are leaders at every level, particularly one that is opening a school, constructing a school, navigating a board of 9 different individuals with all of their personalities and their high priorities, hiring and retaining staff, recruiting families, all of those pieces brings a ton of stress. Now, you've opened the school, K-3, then now K-8 at this point. You are engaged in every bit of the school community, and you're expected to be there, and you hold yourself to this high expectation that you're going to be there. That often what does get overlooked and can't be understated is one's mental health. And it sounds like that's what you're talking about, right? This overlooking of the importance, not just of physical and nutritional and all those kinds of pieces that we all overlook as leaders, but the real importance of paying attention to one's well-being, self, sort of self-care, all of that piece. And I kind of want to go back to it just to ask again, why is that important?
This is it. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about mental health in positions like leadership positions, right? And how do you prioritize it? And for me, what I can say is, well, it took a toll. It took a significant toll for me to being there for my school community. And also, you know, not being present at home toward the end of those 3 years that I was at the helm of the school and serving in his dual capacity, it came to the point where the level of anxiety was way too much. And I'm like, this is not healthy. It's not sustainable. I need to take a step back. And it's one of those things where you have to slow down to go fast. And, you know, what made my decision sort of clear to take a step back from that role was that both of my parents became ill at the same time, and I wasn't there. So I'm like, I'm not sure if I'm going to have my parents tomorrow. I am sure that an opportunity will probably come again. So
yes,
that's how I rationalized my step to, you know, my taking a step back. After hearing from colleagues and people, you just achieved this. Why are you taking a step back? You know, and everybody wants.
Yes,
wants
ego begins to play a role in our heads, right? It's like, well, of course I got to do this, and all these people are counting on me. And yet, there's that metaphor of like being in an airplane. You mentioned the airplane earlier in our conversation about flying it while it's being built. Well, when that oxygen thing comes down, you're supposed to put it on yourself first before you can help others. And it sounded like you needed to take care of you so that you could help others as well. I wonder, what did you learn about relationships throughout this process?
You know, I will say this, the board was extremely supportive, and they paired me up with an amazing leadership coach who really walked me through. And I think I was there for 3 years thanks to her. Otherwise, it would have been shorter time. One of the things that you know, that she talked me through is like, you know, saying no is okay. And having those boundaries around your work is okay. It will make you an actual higher performer than if you try to go 110 every single day nonstop.
I was coaching someone and I said, oh, Brene Brown says clear is kind. And this was a leader of color who said, yeah, but it's not so easy for us to be able to do that. So I'm curious, was your coach or mentor, was that a leader of color or not?
She was not, actually. She was not.
That's interesting to me, because I'm curious how you received similar sort of feedback of, hey, you've got to create some really clear boundaries and parameters. And were you able to sort of hear that? Or how did you respond to hearing that advice?
Yeah, for me, it was difficult because I felt like I was undermining my professional career in a way that I was sort of, shooting myself in the foot. Like how, one, you have to figure out what to say to your boss when, when they're expecting you to do this or be here or be there, do that. And we have this committee meeting, et cetera, et cetera. But you have an obligation with family that you've already sort of made arrangements to. So talking through that takes, take managing up, right? Takes some skill and what to say. And as a person of color, for me, it's so difficult to this day, and that's something that I think I will continue to work on for as long as I'm here. One of the other things that I think leaders often get into is this sort of dynamic of wanting to be there for every one of their team members. And one of the ways that she put it was like this, because I'm like, I end up asking my team members, how can I support you? And I end up with a lot more work. And it's like it's just not sustainable. And she put it this way, why don't you put it like this? How can I support you in achieving this goal?
I'll tell you, my first year as a superintendent, I went to visit a school and I asked the principal as we were walking around the building, I said, "What keeps you up at night?" And oh my gosh, the list was, I became, they were, I was so overwhelmed by all the things that were keeping this individual up. Some of it had nothing to do with the schools, right? But you feel this obligation as a human, as a servant leader, as a human-centered leader to say, "How can I support you and help you do this?" And so my mentor said something very similar in the sense of approach this through an appreciative lens. What's going well, and how can I help you get more of it? So that it's very much narrowed to this focus of I want to be part of your success. And there are some things that you are finding that are really successful and you'd like to see more of it. And how can I be a part of that?
Yes. No, and in terms of relationships, you mentioned like how what this experience gave me is that the relationship with my evaluators, the board, became closer. They actually appreciated that I was asking for me time. And like, you know what, we thought, we don't want you to think you're a robot. Like we know that you need, and sometimes we place a lot more expectations on ourselves than others do. And just pausing for a second and saying, wait a minute, they want me to be effective. They want me to be there, but they also recognize that I do need time.
So I asked you earlier what got overlooked, and you shared mental health was an area that had been overlooked, and relationships with your mentor and with your board seemed to be very positive. My last question before I ask you what was something that was good that came out of this experience is just what could you have done differently? So we know what got overlooked, but what could you have done individually to have made a difference in your situation?
Definitely understanding the duality, the dual roles that I served in is something that I didn't think I understood fully when I embarked on this journey, and really taking the time to understand that. And then the second part of that is being upfront with the people who are going to be supporting you of what your needs are on the personal level, professional, all of that, so. And be unapologetic about that. I remember just, in the role that I have now as a principal here, one of the first conversations I had with my assistant superintendent was like, by the way, this is what I need in order to be successful here. And family is important to me. And after a certain time, like, especially with technology following us everywhere, like I just need this separation in order for me to be here 110% when I'm in the building. So I came out of that experience, honestly, Peter, at the end of those 3 years, I was like, I wanted nothing to do with education. I was in a dark place. My doctor's like, whatever you're doing at work is not helping you. And I just decided to take a step back and, had some time to reflect. Do I want to go back to an environment that is so demanding? And am I willing to make the compromise that I cannot be there 24/7, 7 days a week? And initially, that experience at the charter school as a CEO principal left me with, as Brené Brown says, with a closed heart. I'm like, I knew that. I knew that going into my role as an assistant principal, I was so guarded about anything that I said, about anything that I did. I was like a robot. And I'm like, there's no way to do this. And I'm like, and through the dynamic that I developed with colleagues, with teachers, with community, with students, I also learned that I could not do that work with a closed heart, because this vulnerable community needed people to be real and to be vulnerable and to open up, so that they're able to to ask for the needs or show the needs that they have. I know if I had to redo all over again, I think just setting clear boundaries from the get-go is something that is so important, especially those who are so hard on themselves with results, with performance, and recognizing that, you know, in order for you to get there, you do have to sometimes go slow.
That sounds like a good answer to what was something that was good that came out of this situation, because you did shift from this, the head of school, the founder, the principal, to a role as assistant principal. But that gave you 4 years to refind and rekindle your passion for education, your support for community and children and their families and staff, and to reset and establish what is important to you, both the work that we do, but also the family and the life that we must try to keep balance. And, you know, and there's no real thing as balance in this world. So having this opportunity to really sort of reassert what's important to you and to be able to open up your heart again really sounds like something that was good that came out of this experience. Does that sort of capture?
You got it, Peter. That's it. And I would add to this experience that the last 4 years have been the most intense experience that I've had as an educator. And my God, I think it made me a better human being, just working from a place where you're accepted with all your flaws. And I felt that with the community.
My guest was Julio Nunez, the principal of Roosevelt campus of Norristown Area High School. I really do hope that we stay in touch. You're a pretty special human, my friend, and you are doing extraordinary things for children. And I'm grateful that you were on our show today.
Peter, thank you. Thank you for this platform. I look forward to continuing listening to the amazing speakers that you have and learning from them. So any way that, you know, and same for the public, I'm here to, if they want to reach out and I can be of any help, especially around the topic of mental health. I think that's something that we would like to, I would like to contribute my two cents with that. And it's a pleasure being here.
Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a wood print-inspired Daruma doll butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader, Leadership in After Action.